my hesitation is that if you don't have major philosophical questions, like, what am I doing planting them? And that's a fair hesitation. I hope I'm not making a mistake by offering this. I do believe that the answers are solid, genuinely good enough that it shouldn't cause questions for someone who doesn't have. I genuinely believe that the Torah is min hashamayim, and I think truth will prevail. I also do want to hopefully address issues that may have come up or may come up in life, and therefore I wanted to briefly give a little bit of an overview along where I'm coming from. I'll start with one more thing, which is the Mishnah, because the other says, Dama Shatash V'Lapikores. There's two interpretations of that Mishnah. There's Rabbi Yonah, who believes you should know how to respond to an Apikoros who's on the outside. Someone comes over and says, Torah's not from our Sinai, a bunch of, you know, whatever it is. You have to respond to that person. And there's another one that the Maharal describes, which is Dama Shatash V'Lapikores, but the Apikoros on the inside. We all have a Shtikla Apikoros inside of us, and we have to be able to respond to ourselves as well. And although I don't believe the masters are bothered with these questions, and furthermore, I'm hesitating to discuss this, there are those who may be in the future, and therefore, I think the best place to develop emuna is yeshiva. And that's why I think the overriding, you know, you have to walk out of yeshiva feeling you can handle all sorts of challenges that come up, and it's one of the major challenges that may come up in life, and if I wanted to, what's happening. How the academic scholars look at much of biblical narrative. There's two, I'm going to break my share up into four parts. First is how they look at the overall Tanakh. Number two is authorship of Tanakh. Hopefully, three will be what prompts scholars to draw the conclusions. The floor is maybe the dating of the Bible to some type like that. If you can get through all four, that'd be great. If not, that's fine also. Most of the biblical scholars, the assumption starts off with, if we're looking at this from an academic perspective, not a religious perspective, let's just start off right off the bat, God didn't write this. That is the assumption. It's not even under question, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, maybe the proof's yes, maybe the proof's no. No way possible. Once you start with that assumption, and that's like mamish, you know, dogmatically, you know, you start off with that assumption, so then the question becomes, well, what's the point of the Bible? So a lot of it should be interpreted theologically. Ideologically, I think, means it's the way we look at Greek mythology, Paul Bunyan, these type of stories, and there's all sorts of like nice messages that, you know, for example, James Kogel, a professor in Harvard, wrote a book called How to Read the Bible. He offers two great examples. One is, what's the point of the Adam and Chava story? The answer is to know how did death come about. People were wondering, why is the death, where to come from? And people concocted this story about Adam and Eve, and that's when they figured out where death came from. Similarly, the Migdal Babel story responds, why do we all speak in different languages? Where does the evolution of language come from? So a bunch of people got together and developed this story about Migdal, the Tower of Babel, and all of a sudden now we have the source of different languages. Of course, these stories didn't happen. They picked up over time, and that's the answer to all sorts of like questions that like, how do you explain the things that we have in the world today? And comes along the Bible to answer these questions. There's a book written by a man named Jack Miles, Professor Jack Miles. He wrote a book called God, A Biography. In his book, he basically describes how God develops throughout the Bible. At first, he gets very angry. He's like a fiery God and very, very rash. And as he develops, as the Bible continues, God gets more and more calm, more and more nuanced. God kind of develops. Now, hence the title of the book, God, A Biography. Our response to these type of things is pretty simple. Number one, in terms of the response to, again, James Kogel is actually an Orthodox Jew. He's writing his book to both people. He writes, here's how scholars read it, and here's how Orthodox Jews read it. And nonetheless, he does a good job of giving these examples. how would we respond to the Adam and Eve story? The story is about divine command, obedience, listening to God, the Yetzirah. Perhaps you want to take it one step deeper. The most basic point of the story is when God says do something, you do it. That's like the reason why that story is there. It's important to know that we listen to God when God says something. That's the basic of the story. What happens with rebellion? What happens with disobeying Hashem? That's probably the basic message of that story. You want to take it a little step further. The Chachmei Kabbalah and even the Chachmei Chassidus talk about Tchias HaMeisim and Olam Haba, what the world was supposed to be, and there's like much more deeper. But the point is, there's a religious message that's supposed to be taken out of it, not just an epological message. More than that, the story of Migdal Babel is teaching us about, it's a story about not to rebel or how Hashem punishes people, who disrespect each other more than himself. I think the famous Rashi who points out that the Mabul was a more severe punishment than Migdal Babel. Hashem doesn't want, Hashem Dafka is teaching us a huge message that when you fight against each other, that's worse than fighting against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Very profound religious message. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want these type of societies out there. And every one of these stories has deep, profound religious messages. You find it throughout all of the Mefarshim. You find it through what we're doing when we learn Tanakh together. We ask ourselves, what's the religious message? Sometimes the question is, what's the religious message of this particular letter? What do you gain from the extra love? And sometimes a much bigger question, like, why does God destroy Sodom? And the answer is, at some point in time, the people get so bad, God says, enough is enough. Why does God reward Avram? Look at how he behaves. He's kind and generous and dedicated and frum. There's a lot of deep religious messages that we're pulling out from Tanakh. In terms of response to Jack Miles' claim, in other words, that God developed, my response is really twofold. Number one, I think the observation is incorrect. Hashem is not wild and rampant in terms of killing people in the beginning and then at the end, not. The entire Chumash, sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes, like Migdal Babel, he's very kind and soft and just scatters them around, while in later on in Chumash, you know, he waits 40 years, but he decides to destroy the entire nation and start again. He even says to Moshe, you know, I want to destroy the entire nation. They're psukim in Sefer Bamidbar, where he sends snakes to kill people left and right in plagues. You know, there's situations in Sefer Yirmiyahu and Eicha, which records Hashem's incredible unleashing of punishment. Sefer Iyov doesn't seem to fit the model either, and therefore, A, the observation, I think, is oversimplified, and particularly because it's a particular agenda. But even if it's actually true, and the observation would have been correct, I think the religious message you would take is a far different one, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats different societies differently, and as society matures, as society develops, it could be there's a correlation how HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses to interact with them. Hashem acts differently as people mature. Different Sfarim in Tanakh capture different midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One story emphasizes his mercy, another story emphasizes din, one sefer emphasizes his desire to engage with people, Avram and Stone, Moshe, and sometimes Hashem just comes down and paskins. And I don't think it's one book versus the other book. I think there's a development of how people saw God. And I think there's actually just different nuances. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu determines how to act with the world, and we have to understand with a lot of sophistication and a lot of depth and thought how to understand what the religious message is. That's part number one. Part number two is authorship. Authorship is most prominent in the academic world, one of the most prominent hypotheses, if not the prominent philosophy, if not the prominent hypothesis, and not the only one, is something called the documentary hypothesis. It's originally suggested by a German 18th century thinker named Wilhausen. Wilhausen concocted the following theory that if there's no divine authorship, point number one, you look at the book, there's a lot of contradictions. Well, if there are a lot of contradictions, why are there contradictions? It must be there's different authors, because no one author would have written any book with so many different perspectives. That's essentially where it comes from. He isolates four different authors, J, E, P, and D. J stands for Shem Havayi Yud Kei Vav Kei, E stands for Elohim, P stands for priests, and D stands for Deuteronomy. And those are the four different authors, and then basically there's a guy called R who's the redactor and took a bunch of different scriptures and put them all together and concocted one big book, which we call Chumash, Torah. And he's got all sorts of proofs. If you look, for example, he reads Chumash Bereishis, Perek Aleph, everything there when we refer to God is uses the word Elohim. If you read Perek Beis from Pasuk Dalet Anah, we use the word Yud Kei Vav Kei. And therefore, don't you see that one author referred to God as Hashem and one as Elohim, and they must have had different visions and different perspectives, and you read the different stories and you kind of develop the different theories between who did this. What's our response? So our response is several things. Number one is there's no book in that entire time period that we have any evidence, including the Bible, that is written in such a fashion. None of the other contemporary books at the time of the Bible were written by some guy putting pieces together and collecting and cutting and pasting and coming up with a book at the end. It'd be strange that the Bible is the only one, and especially because there's no archaeological evidence. There's a professor named Christina Hayes, who I took one of her classes online. She's a professor in Yale. And she points out that even though it's a predominant theory in the secular world, she brings up a good question, which is, we've never actually only found D or J or E. We've never actually uncovered, unearthed any of these texts. and all the chirogenesis and all these stuff, we've never actually found any supporting evidence to this. So therefore, at least you have a kasha. Beyond that, how do we resolve this type of question? Well, there's been three different stages in history how to deal with it. Number one was to reject the entire thing. Don't even read it. Just say the whole thing is pasnish and move on. People still say that today, and perhaps even that's a legitimate approach. Maybe even the correct approach. The whole thing is garbage. It's all kfira. I have emunah shleima. Don't bother me. That may be the right for many people. May even be the right approach for everyone, but not everyone's satisfied with that approach. And therefore, we have developed two other approaches to it. Number one is like in a more minor. It looks like this and this and this and this. It looks like there's different authorship here and there. At the end of the day, we have all sorts of technical ways of explaining why this pasuk uses Shem Hashem, this one Shem Elokim, this one presents it this way, this one presents it that way. And then Bamidbar, it looks like Hashem sent the spies, and then Devarim looks like Moshe sent the spies. And we say Moshe was giving them Moshe Shmuz, he wanted to inspire them, etc., etc., all sorts of answers like that. The third approach, and this is really the most modern approach, is really to embrace the observation but draw different conclusions. It's really true. Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 have different perspectives. It's just one divine author opposed to two human authors. The one who said that the clearest is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a book called Lonely Man of Faith, where he describes Adam 1 versus Adam 2 in two entirely different perspectives. And the basic theory is that if you want to understand man in a nuanced way, you have to understand from these two different dimensions. This is essentially what Rabbi Soloveitchik did over there. The one who took it to the next level was a man named Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. I think he passed away. He was a professor in, if I'm not mistaken, Bar-Ilan. He takes it to the next level. He has many, many problems that he discusses, not just Adam 1 and Adam 2, but many, many other examples where the Torah is presenting the same information with two different perspectives to give you a more nuanced, more sophisticated perspective. Good. The last way to handle this is to say something which is a little bit more radical, which is there will maybe even be different authorships. Now, in terms of Chumash, that's like a wild thing to say. But in terms of Nevi'im, you find it more. A lot of the academics believe that the book of Yeshayahu was actually authored by two different prophets named Yeshayahu. Now, although that seems to be pretty uncommonly accepted in the world we come from, the Abarbanel did believe that. You find that throughout Sefer Tehillim. You know, the Ebenezer recalls, these Chachmedes think this pasuk was added on later. This pasuk came on Al Naros Bavel. Where was it written? Major Machlokas. Is it about Nevuah that one day the Jews will sit on the Naharos Bevel yearning to come back? Or was it written while they were actually on the Al Naharos Bevel yearning to come back? Al Naros Bavel, that's goes by his Rishon. That's way after David HaMelech. So, maybe you can discuss exactly authorship. I'm not going to discuss Chumash in that sense. The standard Frumist approach is to follow the Rambam. You know, I'll discuss it briefly. The standard Frumist approach is to follow the Rambam that Kadosh Baruch Hu wrote every single pasuk in the Chumash. Could one disagree? The truth is, according to the Rambam, there doesn't seem to be much room. However, the Gemara itself says maybe Yehoshua wrote the last eight psukim. The Ebenezer builds off that. There's an interesting sheet of Yehuda Chassid. You can take that further. I'm not going to. If you're interested, follow up afterwards, and I'll share with you what I know about that. I'll give you another example of it. There's a book written by a professor from University of Georgia, University of Atlanta, somewhere in Georgia, named Richard Friedman. His theory is who wrote the Bible. That's the name of the book. The name of the book is Who Wrote the Bible. And in it, he goes through and tells you this was written by E, and this by J, and this by this, and this by that. Goes through Mamish, all the psukim, and shows all sorts of stuff. Now, the truth is, his breakup sometimes is very clever, and sometimes it's Mamish ridiculous. His breakup of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, the Rabbi Soloveitchik, Adam 1, Adam 2 thing, it's a very clever breakup. You really get the impression of two different perspectives. We believe it's all from God, and there's a deep religious message there. But he believes there's actually a Noach 1 and a Noach 2. Many people believe there's a Noach 1 and a Noach 2. If you read the Psukim, if you have a Tanakh, you can follow along. If not, you can ask me, I'll tell you after. I'm going to go pretty quickly. You probably won't be able to keep up if you have it. But he believes Noach Perek, I'm going to say the Psukim in English, because I have it in numbers versus English. You know, Perek 6, Psukim 5 through 8 is J, 9 through 22 is P, 1 through 5 or 7 is J, 6 is P, 7 is J, 8 and 9 is P, 10 is J, 11 is P, 12 is J. The first 6 psukim and 8 psukim and 6 psukim and 8 psukim do seem to have like their different perspectives, but then it gets a little crazy. For example, the first half of pasuk, you know, 8 is P, the second half is J, until the next half of the second pasuk, then you have, that's P again. 8-6 is J, 8-7 is P, 8-8 through 12 is J, the first half of 8-13 is P, the second half is J. At some point in time when people wrote half of Pesukim, like the Pesuk doesn't make sense only at half of the Pesuk. Did J write a half of a Pesuk just waiting for P to come in 100 years later, not knowing who he was, and fill it in? It's almost like ridiculous. I take that back. It is ridiculous. It's missing and matching up. So you read the beginning of the Noah story, it's different. I think there's a theory I'm working on. It's not fully done. I was talking to Rav Meizer about it. I actually think that the Bereishis story, God starts off telling you as if Shem Hashem and Shem Havaya and Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, and Elokim are two different names. And then the Noah story, they begin to stagger. And to be honest with you, 90% of Sefer Bereishis mixes and matches Hashem and Yud Kei Vav Kei. It's only Perek Aleph and Beis and 2 or 3 Pesukim of Noah where you see such a distinction. 90% of the book, 85% of the book doesn't distinguish that way. So the evidence is significantly smaller. I quicker believe there's one author just making a particular point. Exactly what that point is still requires a little more. I actually think that there's two components that are separate in the Noah story that kind of integrate. And as life moves on, they actually are, from there on out, an integrated one component. That's why you find Hashem Elokim and interchanged, etc., etc. In any event, if you want, that's how you respond to the, their claims. I think the overarching support to our things is really, it starts off by a book called Who Really Wrote the Bible, written by two Jewish religious biblical scholars from Los Angeles. One is an Israeli guy whose name is Eyal Rav Noy, and one is a guy called Gil Weinreich. They wrote a book called Who Really Wrote the Bible, and in it they highlight that it's impossible for this whole theory to be correct, and unless it's shockingly coincidental. There's so many chiasms in the Tanakh. If you find 4 prakim where it goes A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A, and 5 different authors put in different things, what are the odds of having such a beautiful pattern? If, let's say, you find the patterns of the ten plagues, the first 3 all by one person, Aaron, the second are by Moshe, third 3 are by Hashem. Every first 2 of 3, 1, 2, not 3, 4, 5, not 6, 7, 8, not 9, all have warnings, while 3, 6, and 9 don't have warnings. That's really, really coincidental. If many authors have put this together, you go through Friedman's book, he believes the 10 plagues were written by different people. He believes a lot of these things were written by different people. It really undermines an incredible amount of literary beauty that the Tanakh seems to be full of. One of the things that I do in my double take shiurim, in my Tanakh personality shiurim, is show 1,000,001 parallels. It's really unlikely for Sefer Shmos to be quoting Bereishis with 15-16 linguistic and thematic similarities, if what? If the different authors who never heard of each other. It's shocking how coincidental that would be. And if there's one example of Tanakh, maybe, but if there's 25 examples in Sefer and Chumash, where you clearly see one quoting the other, they're at least, if you want to say different others, at least they're aware of each other, in which case you've lost everything that you, all the reason you had for saying with different authors in the first place, which is you solve contradictions. The interest is more parallels than there are contradictions, and therefore, I think that's another major attack against the theory. In terms of, just going back, the Shtei Bechin, or Mordechai Breuer is the one who, again, if you do have textual problems, this seems to indicate this, seems to indicate that. So there are all sorts of great theories out there. One theory out there is a guy who's a good friend of mine, Barak Moore. Remember, he came in last year, he liked him a lot. He does an excellent job. He's a graduate of Princeton, and he went back to teach this particular theory there a few times. It kind of caught on. He wants to put it to print. His theory. The basic theory is when the Chumash is written, often the perspective is not God, but rather the characters. In other words, sometimes you'll hear, who did the brothers sell Yosef to, the Midyanim or the Ishmaelim? So it's almost like a contradiction in the Pesukim. So it could be that those 4 stories have 2 different authors and just kind of like someone matched together in an unbelievably sound and cohesive fashion. Or it could be it's actually one author who's just using 2 different terms. What terms would he use? So his theory on this thing is they actually were Midyanim. So when Hashem is talking from Hashem's perspective, they're Midyanim. But the brothers called them Yishmaelim. Why? Because they wanted to Yishmael him. Basically, they wanted to say, Yosef, you're the Yishmael of the family. You're part of the Yishmael side of the family. You're sold. You're not one of us. And that would actually make a lot of sense based, if this is the correct theory, I think the Medrash actually drives that home, because the Medrash points out, when they took off his coat, they didn't just take off his ksonas pasim, they took off a second coat, the Tosuk says. So why a second coat? The Medrash quotes that. Medrash says, Rashi quotes, they wanted to show him, you're not just the special son, you're not even any of us. They took off his ksonas pasim, highlighting you're not different, and they took off his brotherly coat, the one that all the brothers had, saying, you're not even one of us. Again, you're like the Yishmael of the family, the Yishmael Esav. So they sold him to Yishmaelim. It may just be through their eyes what they were doing is sending him up to the Yishmael world. There are many, many, many of these type of things. If anyone's interested, you can take a look in the Double Take book. There's a great example of that in a chapter about Rivka, where the Torah sometimes calls Eliezer, or whoever the slave was, Eved, and sometimes Ish. It depends upon what hat he's wearing. Numerous times in Chumash do you do that. Depends on whose perspective the story is being told from, in which case, that would certainly solve a lot as well. The theory basically is that some of the observations they made were correct. That doesn't mean the conclusions they draw were correct. And A, the conclusions often, from an objective perspective, would face this way, and certainly take into account the chiasms and the parallels and everything else which would indicate this, would certainly be a something you should feel comfortable with. Next. There are a couple of psukim in there that even Mefarshim seem to struggle with. For example, the pasuk of Akhnati Uz Bar. So I mean Uz, then and not now. So there is an Ibn Ezra who says a fascinating thing. He goes, yeah, it's a very, very deep shot. I can't tell you what it is, but Hamei bin Yavin. Now, what does he mean by that? Says Machlokas Achronim, what he means by that. Some Achronim say what he means is God actually, it's a big secret. Some say the big secret is that God, this pasuk was added in later. These three words, Vaknani, Uzbar, it's three words. Others would tell you, no. What the Ibn Ezra means is something else. I don't know what he means. How can I know? He didn't tell me. It was a secret. And there are others who interpret the pasuk differently. According to Rashi, it means the Kananim had just come. They just immediately got there. Uz, emigiu. And if you look a little bit later in, let's just say instead of Yud Beis Vav, you look in Yud Gimel Zayin, the Torah a little bit later on says, V'hakanani v'aprizi oz v'aretz. As if to say, the Chumash is letting you know that other nations are moving in the land because Klal Yisrael is not yet ready for it. When we're ready, we'll come back. In the meantime, it's being filled up by other people. First it was only Kanani, then Kanani and Parizi, ultimately became all seven nations. Chumash is driving home some particular point. A lot of these type of phrases, Ad Hayom Hazeh, things along that nature should be dealt with as well, but in my short amount of time, I'm not going to discuss that. Okay. What prompts a lot of the biblical critics / scholars to draw their conclusions? Honestly, I'm not even sure how to answer this. maybe you should ask them. But I do believe the starting point comes from Hashem doesn't exist. God did not write the Bible. Even if you're a believer, if you want to study this on an academic way, not a philosophical way, but a biblically scholarly way, you only look at what you have in front of you, and therefore don't even bother about the God thing. I think that's where a lot of comes from. There are some contradictions, different styles of writing, and I think a lot of it comes from a genuine, deep, and profound disrespect for prehistory. It's seen as unsophisticated. There's no way there could be a sophisticated book. Right off the bat, there's a contradiction. We're lucky they were even educated enough to write. That they even had the ability to communicate thoughts. They were so unsophisticated and so, you know, prehistoric and just you know, the utter stupidity and ignorance of everything they were. It's so difficult to look back. You know, I guess the Harifa said the arrogance, but even the natural thought of the progressive world is we're so much smarter. The wisdom is only in the future, not in the past. I think a lot of that comes to this as well. If you want to talk about the dating of the Bible, this is point number four. Many of the scholars believe that the dating of the Bible did not occur when we believed it occurred. They believed it occurred in the times of the Malachim, the kings. And actually, Friedman, I think, articulates the theory the best, that a lot of the stories are pro-Yehuda, a lot of them are pro-Yisrael, and that's because J and E came from different kingdoms, and the whole Chumash is written with a political agenda. That's the basic theory. Our response is on two levels. Number one is, each story has a religious message, not a political one. The reason that you mentioned the Aaron HaKohen story sitting with the Chena Ego is not because you dislike priests and you're making a political point against them. The reason why you mentioned the Yehuda and Tamar story is not because you believe Yehuda was a terrible person because you come from the north and you don't like Yehuda. I'll share with you my thoughts on Yehuda in tomorrow's story, although if you want to read it properly, you can come to the shir I gave, or it's recorded, or it will be on the next book. The Yehuda in Tamar story, I think, is it's Yehuda falling apart and building himself back up. Selfishly treating Tamar, having his children die, his whole life spiraling out of control, and then saying, Sad Kaimedi, and climbing himself out. And the basic theory is, and it's done, I'm not doing justice to it right now, but don't think when Yehuda was responsible for selling Yosef, it didn't impact the bully as well. Bullying impacts the bully. And when Yehuda pushed Yosef in the pit, Yosef physically fell, and Yehuda spiritually fell. And the Yehuda and Tamar story is placed genuinely right in the middle of the Yosef story to A, tell you they're connected, not to see them as two separate stories, and B, as if you opened up the Yosef story to make a pit and you stuck Yehuda's story right in between, that's exactly where it's placed. Not that some R misplaced the story and accidentally stuck it where it belongs, but rather there's a deep, profound message to it. And therefore, you go through each particular story, and they're not political agendas, they're deep, profound religious agendas. Beyond that, there's a professor named Josh Berman, who lives here in Beit Shemesh. He's a professor in Bar-Ilan. And he has an excellent article written up. I emailed him about it a few times. I added on to it. He was so... I feel a little bit of pride because I shared with him a really cool insight. I think he liked it. He's like, wow, what a great insight. So I got excited about that. What can I say? He spoke to my ego, man. One of my strongest yetzeres. In any event, Professor Josh Berman has a fascinating argument. The argument is as follows. Much of the Torah is a not from side and a from side to it. So I'll share with you and hopefully you like the from side. If it's not from side, it's not so bad also. His argument is that much of the Torah's description of what occurred could have only been recorded if the author was aware of what took place in the Exodus itself and not centuries later. Meaning you can make up a random story, they went to the water, they didn't go. If you don't have details, you can make up any story you want. However, he points out, if you notice there's a shockingly strong similarity between the actual physical structure of the Mishkan and the center of Egyptian gods' temples in Egypt. Who would have known that unless someone who lived right afterwards? Number two, the Az Yashir song has a lot of similarity to an ancient Egyptian military song. The phrase Yad Chazakah, thrown into Yah, used to describe Paro. His theory is that if the Jews ripped it off, maybe that's an out-from side of the Vart, and I'll try to defend that if it's really true. I'm not sure if the theory is true, but it's an interesting theory. His theory is that there's no way someone who lived 800 years later in the land of Israel would have possibly known an 800-year-old Egyptian military song. Lamashal, does anyone know any 1,200 Italian military songs? Or how about French military songs? And that's in the modern world where you can go online and probably download something. You want to talk about thousands of years ago, it's shocking, he argues, that this was written in the 6th century, you know, BCE, in the times of the kings, 800 years after this Egyptian military song was no longer sung. How would they possibly have known about these type of Yad Chazakah, Bezron Netuyah, etc., etc.? In any event, when I read this theory of Professor Berman, I'm not sure, because it does have a not-from side to it, which I mentioned a moment ago. It's like the Jews ripped off these type of things. It could be it's not true, and the whole thing is just pastiche because it's not true. And if that's the case, fine. You don't have this proof against documentary hypothesis. You just have to use the other ones. However, if his theory is true, I was thinking there may be a firm way to look at it, which is, for starters, how did all of Yisrael know how to sing Az Yashir? The answer is, it was a natural song that everyone was singing. And beyond that, there was a deep theological battle between Paro and Hashem throughout all of Sefer Shmos. It's not just the story of the Exodus. It's who is the right God. Paro, according to the Medrash, to wake up in the morning and go to the bathroom, so everyone thinks he's the divine, the deity, the right God. And we try to prove that Hashem is. If that's correct, the basic point is Hashem dethroned Paro. He took the status of Yad Chazakah, Zeron, and Tuyah. He took his home. There's a lot of reasons why the Mishkan may have the structure it does, but one of them may be Hashem dethroned Paro in the eyes of the Midstream. And the best way to do that is to sing the Paro victory song about Hashem. The best way to sing the Paro temple perspective is put Hashem inside as if Hashem went in, Kivayachol, and won the war. I thought that may be a firm way of looking at it. If that's true, there's a fascinating pasuk. If you look in Shmos, Parak Vav, Pasuk Aleph, the Torah says, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, God said to Moshe, Atah, now, Tire asher asel aparo. Take a look at what I'll do to Paro. Kibiyad chazaka yishalchein. Uviyad chazaka yigarshein meyartzo. Who is using the yad chazaka to be yishalchein? Watch what I'm going to do to Paro. Ki biyad chazaka yishalchein. It sounds like Paro's yad chazaka was to send them out. It sounds like Paro's yad chazaka was yigar shem yad so. Parak vav pasigal sounds like Paro has the yad chazaka. Not only is that the pasuk pshat and the pasuk, it's actually a gur aryeh. The gur aryeh believes that that's how Rashi understood the pasuk, that it's Paro's yad chazaka. If that's the case, if Paro starts off with the yad chazaka, and we then later on say HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeemed us biyad chazaka, what's the implication? Hashem beat Paro and took the Yad Chazaka. And a lot of the beginning of Sefer Shemos is all about Laman Yeda, Laman Teidu, Laman this, Laman that. People should know that God beat Paro. The more you realize God beat Paro, the most prominent, aristocratic, polytheistic, modern God in the world in those times, the more you realize who Hashem is. It's like us walking around saying, Hashem beat Richard Dawkins. Hashem beat the Pope. It's not that there's a real competition, but from people's eyes, it's a genuine struggle. And the goal of Mitzrayim may have been a deep, profound theological message, which was, Hashem beat them. If that's correct, perhaps his spin on things, and this proof may actually be a little bit firmer than we had originally started off with. Rabbosai, we'll stop here and go to Abin. Thank you.